Today we continue our study on the rudiments unto perfection, the whole counsel of God, lesson 21, which is called Of Judgment and Chance. Of Judgment and Chance. It is our habit as individuals to naturalize everything, to put a natural interpretation, it just happened, or just sheer chance that such and so happened. Particularly when it's God's hand, we tend not to ascribe judgment and wrath upon a nation to God. It's just something that happened by chance. For example, we know that many times the nation of Israel just said, oh well, we got invaded, or an army did this or that from another country. Didn't see God's hand in it, even though the scriptures were so obvious that God was the one sending these destroyers in each time. O Assyrian, rot of my anger, from Isaiah 10, verse 15 to 18. God was angry. He's going to use the rod on Israel, and what was his choice of rod? An angry Assyrian host, an army, going in to blast them. So, over and over again, the clash of nations, as empire struck against empire and blew each other away, was the hand of God, no less of one than God. He says, he is the one recalled from Matthew 10:34, I will send a sword upon the earth, not peace, but I will fling a sword on the earth. God's the one flinging the sword. It's a divine judgment, and God is wholly the author of it. There's no element of chance or contingency about it. Now, that's very plain and clear when we look at external judgment from other nations, the war and the battles and things like that, such as going on in Yugoslavia, or what once was Yugoslavia. We see the clash of giant armies and divisions on hills, over cities, embattled bunkers, garrisons, etc. But what happens when you have a mighty nation that has and holds empire over the entire known world? And we've had four such nations. Egypt was the first great dynasty, followed by the others, all the way up to Rome, a gigantic empire that stretched from one end of Asia to beyond Europe to the British Isles and down into Africa. Such was the extent of these gigantic nations, and they were monolithic monsters. How does God deal with a monstrous nation that under normal circumstance could not be judged by another incursion of an external army just because it's just too big to attack? Not that this would ever bother God, mind you. But the assumption is now that this nation is at the forefront and is a mighty empire, whatever happens couldn't be God's judgment, notwithstanding the scriptures. But we find out from the Bible that God not only can judge a nation externally, which he uses frequently, he can judge it internally. And we're going to see exactly how God metes out his judgment and justice on a great nation and does it from the inside out. Doesn't have to come in from the outside with an invading host. God can use all sorts of methods. But you'll find out as we read this chapter of Scripture that a lot of the things that we're going to hear, we're going to start saying, but most of those are ascribed to just natural causes or social effects or recessions and depressions and bad trade and who knows what, droughts. But what we find out is that every single one of these is an embodiment of God's riding on a swift light cloud against the nation. It has nothing to do with natural causes. It's purely divine working, an outworking of God's burden or penalty against the nation. And he does it internally when he's dealing with the mighty superpowers. We got superpowers today. America supposedly is the last superpower. We hear this all the time. Well, all the more reason not to be worried about external attack, because God's method apparently with the superpowers is internal destruction and decay and judgment. And we're going to see an awful lot of similarity between what happens here to Egypt, which is our case in point for today, and today's superpower, America. Turn to Isaiah 19. And that's why the title of the lesson is Of Judgment and Chance, because I want to eradicate the notion that there's anything chancy, contingent, natural, unfortunate about these occurrences. They are all divinely, providentially ordered, planned, and executed by God. He thought of it, planned out who's going to do it, and he does it. And there's nothing, no one can stay his hand or stop him or say, what are you doing? And he does it internally, and he confounds the people this way. Verse 19, the burden of Egypt. Behold, the Lord rideth upon a swift cloud, and shall come into Egypt, And the idols of Egypt shall be moved at his presence, and the heart of Egypt shall melt in the midst of it. Notice that Egypt is named three times in the one verse. I think that's pretty clear who he's going after, and he's naming them by name. God names names when he goes after people. He's not generalizing or making things vague. He's making it very clear. Now, what was Egypt's sin? Specifically, they were seducing Israel into faulty alliances and reliance on pagan gods. So they were a seducer of Israel. That's why we'll find out later at the end of this prophecy how it is that God returns the favor for their seductions. Verse 2, "And I will set the Egyptians against the Egyptians." Now, intriguingly, the better rendering of this verse, as most of the scholars, Kyle and Delitzsch, Calvin and others have rendered it, is, "I shall set Egypt against Egypt." Here it's personified, "I'll set Egyptians against the Egyptians," but literally, "I will set Egypt against Egypt," which is an intriguing notion about a total internal clash, a driving together of opposites, and a setting a spirit of contrariness, and setting such a division between the people that strife would prevail. "I will set Egypt against Egypt." It would be like I'm going to set the Celebrities against the Celebrities, so I'm going to set Gestaldos against Gestaldos, or I'm going to set American Episcopalian Church against the American Episcopalian Church, or I'm going to set America against America, or Germany against Germany. Well, you get the idea, is that now the thing is turned on and attacking itself. God, if God doesn't have a suitable nation to come in and attack, simply because he hasn't raised one up, God is still free to judge. And how does he, if Egypt's deserving a judgment, then God will take Egypt and turn it against Egypt, actually force a nation to destroy itself as God's just penalty for their deeds. See, so he will turn Egypt against Egypt. So we're talking about strife, internal. Egypt being for Egypt and shouldn't fight for Egypt, and purpose to move Egypt's purpose forward, now goes against itself. Rather than everything going in one direction in Egypt's favor, everything is turned in toward Egypt's destruction and demolition. Notice, now he starts to enumerate, "And they shall fight everyone against his brother." So we start at the lowest level, brother against brother. Literal blood brothers shall be turned against each other. So we start at the most local level. God starts to destroy the relationship between brothers in families. Then he expands the circle, "And everyone against his neighbor." So within the household, division and strife. Egypt is turned against Egypt. Then the local houses around there, your neighbors in their immediate vicinity. One neighbor against another. Cross purposes, strife, division, fighting. So neighborly fighting. The bond of peace and the covenant of common purpose is now destroyed between house and house. Let alone inside the house, the members of the house are already at war. Egypt turned against itself. And then, says, city against city. So even the cities now are turned against each other. This is how God says, "I'm going to turn Egypt against Egypt. I'm going to start at the lowest level. I'm going to destroy the relationship between the brothers. Then I'm going to destroy the nationship between neighbors. Then I'm going to make the cities go to war against each other. And finally, nation against nation." So happens that Egypt was made up of 12 major provinces after they were consolidated around the time of Simiticus. But before that, around 36, each of these were major provinces, kind of like the United States of America is today. Different sovereign regions, but all bound together under Pharaoh, or the great house of the rulers. So what happens is that from the smallest, minutest, grassroots level up to the largest political bodies, they are all going to be set at variance against each other. And it's going to be nothing but bitterness, strife, battles, you name it. Just a miserable situation. This is how God starts the judgment. And we see very clearly it's an internal judgment. Internal judgment. God doesn't need to send another rod. God can use any instrument at his disposal to judge. Now this just looks like, well, there's a lot of conflict in the society. There's culture clash and all sorts of things. But that's not just a happening that happens by itself. God is the author of it. Because that bond of peace is a gift of God, he can withdraw it because he doesn't owe it to man. Because he didn't owe men to have the same language when they built the Tower of Babel. He was under no obligation to have them speak so they could understand each other. So he confounded the language and confused it. So too here, the bond of peace, God's author of peace, "There is no peace, saith the Lord to the wicked. Normally, he graciously allows there to be peace, but when he's judging Egypt, he just takes it away. Why should he bless them with something they do not deserve? And so we see all the things in the society just caving in on themselves at every level. Families being destroyed, neighborhoods in uproar, cities against cities vying for different purposes. We see it all the time. I don't want that prison in my backyard, you know, things like that, NIMBY and stuff like that. And one state complaining to another about federal funds and why they didn't get it because their air was a little dirtier. And every time they have a conference of mayors or governors, they're attacking the president and each other for what they're doing. Similar to what Egypt was experiencing. Kingdom against kingdom, that is the biggest political sections of Egypt were arrayed against each other now. See? And there's nothing chance about it. There's no element of naturalness in it. It is all a work of God. God comes in on the swift cloud and says, I will set Egypt against Egypt. And since he holds the hearts of kings and anyone else in his hand and directs them as the water courses, he can pull this stunt off. God sure can. He can wreak justice and vengeance internally. Doesn't need to use the other nations. That's why we make such a big mistake. We suddenly say here in America today, Russia falls, no more big enemies. You got a big enemy sitting up in the heavens because of what we do. And he doesn't need to have another nation to scare us. Egypt wasn't scared. They were sitting at the top of their empire, just as we are today. They were heavily armed, gigantic. You know, their horses were the very things that God forbade Israel in Deuteronomy 17:16 to ever seek unto. He says, you're not going to go that way anymore. You're not going to accumulate for yourself any more horsemen from Egypt, because they saw the big horses and the power of their armies on horseback to cavalry and said, we want that. A strong nation has that. We want that. We want to be strong like them. Okay. So too, we pretend to have great strength and might. But the point is, God isn't therefore clearly going to use another nation. Sure, Russia was always off there in the wings to chastise us. Doesn't mean that was God's method. A lot of preachers have preached on it, that maybe Russia's going to come in and give us what we deserve. And perhaps we did well deserve it. But we see that God is not limited to that mode of judgment on a nation at all. We see here the total destruction of the culture. Verse 3, and the spirit of Egypt shall fail in the midst thereof. What that literally means is spirit should be better rendered intellect. That is the intelligence, the wiseness, or the wisdom, if you will, the intelligence, the intellectual power of Egypt shall be emptied out, shall be poured away, shall be made empty. See? So now there is a general destruction and, decay of the level of intelligence. Powers of thinking, the ability of Egypt to think properly, is sapped away by God. It is emptied away. The spirit of Egypt, which is the intellectual spirit of Egypt, is going to be emptied away. This is part of the process of internal judgment that God uses. And it's going to take some time. We'll find out eventually that as we go course our way through this chapter, that God will eventually redeem Egypt. But he's got to beat them over the head with the 2x4 for them to finally say, Jehovah, you're the one we want to worship. We've been blowing it this whole time. But boy, does he really need to nail them on the head before they pay attention. Such is the way of the pagan man. The unbeliever. So, he destroys the level of intelligence. And so, it is emptied out. What this tells us, by the way, is that the very fact that there was a spirit of intellectual power in Egypt was whose doing? Who should be credited for it? God! He emptied it. He's the one who provided it. You know, there was a saying of a pagan philosopher. He said, the greatest gift that God can give is his prosperous blessings on the people, and the best gift that people can give is prudence. And when you listen to that phrase, you realize that means that God isn't the author of the prudence that people possess. In a way, it's a nice sounding phrase, but under the surface, it's an attack against God being the provider of our own intelligence and our own wisdom and our own judgment and discernment. See, so that pagan philosopher was giving men credit for something that God gives. So too, though they probably assumed that wisdom was born with them, God, being the proper giver of it, can take it away. Job made the very thing God giveth. God can take it away. He's under no obligation to let you keep it. Why should he? Remember what Jesus made the comment? He said, the vineyard will be taken away from these and given to someone who will bear the fruits thereof. You know, you're improperly using something that God gives you, God will take it away and give it to someone who will use it, including intelligence. And I will destroy the counsel thereof, that is, their planning abilities, the ability to plan ahead and to counsel and to do things. This includes, by the way, their penchant for predicting the future using astrology and other means. And they shall seek to the idols and to the charmers and to them that have familiar spirits and to the wizards. You see, they will, though God takes away counsel, takes away their ability to plan and to look into the future and to make wise decisions, they still will go back to their idols, to their charmers, astrologers, magicians. But they're not going to get anything out of them, because since God, you remember, it's a black art in the sense that it is a forbidden, unlawful way to look into the future. And some of it was phony, some of it was demonic. God allowed some demonic activity to go on so they can sometimes get a pretty good read on the future, unlawfully. Well, God even stops the demons from answering their questions, and now even their ability to tell the future is blown away. See, so the council is destroyed in the middle of the nation, which means that all their forecasts are coming to nothing. They're totally blown away. Their economic forecasts come to naught, their weather forecasts come to naught, their political forecasts are worthless, are vain. God destroys counsel. So the ability to be prudent, to plan, is all leveled by God. And the Egyptians will I give over into the hand of a cruel lord and a fierce king, or rather a rigorous king, a stern one, shall rule over them, saith the Lord of hosts. So now he puts them in a position where they are going to lose liberty. Because this is one of the big warnings that Samuel gave the people when they wanted a king. Give us a king. He said, well, you know, it's going to be real. It'll be real stern and fierce and control you and tyrannize you. Tyrannize. We still want a king. This is one of the things that befalls people. When you have a nice, benevolent king, fine. Most of the pharaohs, they were mixed a lot. But he's telling them, you're going to have a real meanie on the throne. And he's going to be very stern. And being stern and powerful and rigorous, you're not going to be able to escape. It's going to be very difficult to resecure the liberties once that strong guy is on the throne. We talk about it's a Panamanian strongman and the Venezuelan strongman and the Guatemalan strongman. Because we talk about someone who's going to be very hard to topple, who rules with an iron fist. But once you impose something like that, it's very hard to regain the liberties lost to somebody who decides he wants a tight fist on his people. And no one's going to squeeze out of his fingers. Tax-wise, power-wise, whatever he commands is law. So now they lose some liberties because of the stern, fierce, cruel lord over them. And the waters shall fail from the sea, and the river shall be wasted and dried up, and they shall turn the rivers far away, and the brooks of defense shall be emptied and dried up, the reeds and flags shall wither. Here now God is starting to attack the natural realm, drying up the land with droughts. Remember, for in Egypt, the Nile was everything. They in fact regarded it as a virtual ocean because it was such a large thing, and it was the source of all their life. The Nile didn't overflood its banks, they were ruined. It was serious trouble. It wasn't functioning like it's supposed to function. It had a Nile god, that's how important and central it was, more so than the sun to them. It was a Nile god. So here, God hits them where it really hurts. Their main sources of sustenance and supply in the nation, God pulls them away. The paper reeds by the brooks, by the mouth of the brooks, and everything sown by the brooks shall wither, shall be driven away and be no more. And that's pretty serious, because if just the reeds that are planted near the river are dried up, how are we going to do down the line where they need the agricultural water? I mean, the richest, wettest place would be right next to the Nile and its tributaries and various, you know, offsetting fingers of the and arms of that particular water body, because they also have, you know, canals and irrigation plans. But if things that are right next to the Nile are dried up, they're going to be real bad shape out in the fields where they need it. Serious drought problems. But this is part of God's riding on the swift cloud in judgment. See? So we have, at the beginning, the destruction of the people's peacefulness and ability to coexist properly. And then, now we're having the natural collisions and catastrophes. And now, verse 8, the economic consequences. The fishers also shall mourn, and all they that cast angle to the brooks, into the brooks shall lament. And they that spread nets upon the waters shall languish. Now, this is awfully serious because, you know, the biggest industry of Egypt is fishing. So God doesn't hit them in one of the minor industries off to the side. Their main source of food gets blown away. It's off the map now. And they're mourning. They throw nets and nothing comes up. Again and again and again. God destroyed their main industry. It withered it away. It's gone. Even attempts made to protect it are going to be destroyed. They languish, lament, mourn. Verse 9, moreover, they that work in fine flax and they that weave networks shall be confounded. The second big thing that Egypt was famous for was its fine linen industry, which was mentioned several times in Scripture, Kings, etc. Fineness, you know, they had a tremendous trade in it. Very, like we talk about Chinese silk. Well, the same thing for Egyptian linens and cloth and network lacings and things like that. And they just couldn't find any buyers for it. The market fell through on the marine thing. In the case of the fish, well, they don't have any fish to eat, they don't have any fish to sell, they don't have any fish to catch, which brings rise to the first two problems. And here, there's a drought going on, so there's going to be less flax to harvest, so there's going to be less ability to create these things. And what they do create, there's no market for, astonishingly. Demand and supply go down the toilet, as it were. So even the fine works of the hand, see, the one you're talking about, fish, that's something that's natural in the land, but here, even the work of man's artifice, labor, building and making this cloth, that isn't any good anymore either. They used to ply that trade, and now it's worthless. It gets them nowhere. It's a dead industry all of a sudden, and rocked by a depression. And they shall be broken in the purposes thereof, all that makes sluices and ponds for fish. What this is saying here is that when once the drought effects are started to notice, smart fishermen build a pond and sluice gates so that they can, you know, hoard some water and keep the fish growing in there so they can do it. But God even blows away these attempts to get around his judgment. For those who remember how many times Israel had no interest in sticking around in Babylon for the 70 years it was accounted for, God said, you stay. There's no getting around it, and anyone who attempts to get back prior to the right time, they will not prevail. So too, all attempts to get around God's judgment and say, drought's coming, let's build a fish hatchery, let's dig a pond, put water in, protect the fish and save them because the Nile is receding now, even this will come to nothing. So even men's attempts to try to subvert and put back together what God is tearing apart fail, will come to nothing. And again, it's all internal judgment on the people. Verse 11, now we get back to a more interesting area. Surely the princes of Zoan are fools, or have become fools. The counsel of the wise counselors of Pharaoh is become brutish. The princes of Zoan, Zoan's one of the big cities, a major city, in fact, according to the Book of Numbers, and one of the ancient ones, one of the 12 major cities. Noph is another one, of course, we talk about Momemphis and things that we now call Alexandria, after Alexander came and conquered the place. Just like Leningrad, now back to St. Petersburg. Alexandria had a different name prior to this time. Now we find what? That the princes are become fools. The fact that the ruling class, the government of the people, plus the advisors to the government, advisors to the Pharaoh, all lose their ability to think right. They become irrational in their thinking. They lose all sense of right and wrong, of wise and stupid, and they revert to foolishness and vanity. They become infatuated, is the way Calvin renders it. Become idiotic. They become that, and why do they become that? It's not natural, it's not a disease spreading through. God pulls away their ability to discern and judge things properly. Just snatches it away. And therefore, they revert to what they are without God supporting them in the ability to think right and to rule wisely as a governing class. And that's pulled away from them. The counsel of the wise counselors of Pharaoh is become brutish. How say ye unto Pharaoh, I am the son of the wise, the son of ancient kings? You see, the appeal of these advisors is, we are sons of the wise. So they appeal to existing wisdom. We are smart people. We were trained by wise men ourselves, so we are wise. So the appeal is to their intelligence, their PhDs, their sheepskins, you name it. They're great centers of learning, like saying, well, I have 5 PhDs and I was a professor emeritus at such and so, this kind of thing that you're saying. So they have an appeal, one, A, to intelligence and wisdom. Second appeal is the son of ancient kings, meaning there's an appeal to antiquity. of how far back their line goes, and therefore they are, there's an endorsement, as it were, from the past and from their PhDs, if you will, putting it in 20th century language. But you see, none of those things are of value, because everything is coming to naught and they're still fools. So what we have here is an appeal, verbal appeal, by these advisors to the rulers that they are wise, they can prove it, and that they come from a long distinguished line of wise people going back into antiquity, which they can also prove. But it doesn't change the fact that God has given them over to foolishness and vanity and is going to destroy and bring to naught the counsel of the people, because he's already set stupidity into the hearts of the rulers. That is, the government, the political government, and the political process has now been deprived of wisdom and discernment by God. So, on the surface, they're mouthing the words, "We are wise, we are the sons of ancient kings." You can almost hear Ted Kennedy saying, "I'm related to, you know, the President of the United States," and things like that. It's totally irrelevant. It does not change the fact. Matter of fact, God says, why are they saying these things, seeing as how I've made them fools, and they're still trying to convince everybody that they're doing right, and that they're wise rulers and advisors to the rulers. Verse 12, where are they? Where are thy wise men? And let them tell thee now, and let them know what the Lord of hosts hath purposed upon Egypt. What he's really saying is, since everything is falling to pieces, what these people should at least by now admit is that this thing that's happening to Egypt is brought upon it by God, and is reflecting and proving and bearing out that God's purposes on Egypt are being inflicted and executed. So at least admit it now, having seen that the nation is risen up against itself. Verse 13, the princes of Zoan are become fools, the princes of Noph are deceived. They have also seduced Egypt, even they that are the stay of the tribes thereof. Now, it's that last clause that's totally intriguing. God undermines the nation by undermining the intellect and the power to discern and think of the main rulers. See, these are the princes of Zoan, princes of Noph, that is, the main rulers of the various provinces. You're talking about the ruling class, the government, the governing individuals, civil rulers. And he says, they are the stay of the people and of the nation, the stay of the tribes thereof. Now, we talk about stay usually in a composite sense. Everyone knows what I mean if I say potatoes are the mainstay of Irish diet. You say, well, that's the main portion that supports everything else. So we know what a mainstay is. It's the mainstay of this, the mainstay of that. When you take the word main away and just have the word stay, that has a significant meaning in a similar sense. It is a support. In fact, this word can be rendered the corner or cornerstone as well of a building which supports the rest of it, a stay. In fact, it has a sailing significance too when we talk about a stay. So in terms of a line that supports things. So in this sense, we learn that civil government is the stay of the tribes. And so when God decides to execute internal judgment on a nation, he undermines civil government by putting idiots in charge and destroying the intelligence of what rulers you do have. He takes away their power to discern. Their wisdom and their prudence comes to nothing. You see? So they become fools, and they are those that seduce, because now their counsel, what? The counsel of these civil rulers is faulty, is erroneous, is irrational, and is idiotic, and the whole nation follows them because they seduce the whole nation along with them. So the princes of Zoan and Noph prevail in their idiocy, and the nation follows after it. So too the civil rulers in any government with an internal judgment of God being executed on it will follow after its rulers. They'll follow after their Congress or Senate when they make idiotic decisions and pass stupid laws that violate all common sense and all biblical precedent. But what else was going to happen? That shows how complete God's judgment is. He's not just going after the little folk. He says, I'm going to go after the stays, the mainstay of the nation. The cornerstones are going to get nailed, and that means the civil rulers. So this should really send up red flags to us when we see civil rulers going down the tubes. Is this God flying in on the swift cloud? What have we done? You know, it takes a real severe beating for Egypt to finally get the message and become a redeemed nation. Let's hope we don't need to go so far as a superpower in this country. But we're very, very proud and arrogant today. We presume things that Egypt would not have presumed. So, verse 14, the Lord hath mingled a perverse spirit in the midst of thereof, and they have caused Egypt to err in every work thereof, as a drunken man staggereth in his vomit. See, the Lord, who makes that perverse spirit, which is really a spirit of dizziness or of perverse really means to cause things to collide together, to cause things to go. Mephet, the Latin probably is best, it says it's a spirit of vertigo, if you will, dizziness, just like this. He is causing them, the intellect and their minds, to go off the deep end. And who brings it upon them? Jehovah, God, does it. Doesn't this happen? Say, boy, things are falling apart. Don't just say, things are falling apart. Say, God removed all the screws and bolts and things are falling apart. Because only by merit of God cementing a nation shall it stand. And if it fails to observe God's law, he will pull the screws and bolts out that hold it together. And all in the main places. And great is the crash thereof. And some of these screws and these bolts are the civil rulers. And he just undoes the bolts and unscrews them and pulls out the nails. And it falls like it ought to, because it doesn't deserve to be held together if it's so contrary to God's purpose for it. God's not mocked, never is, never shall be. So he sends and mingles, he says he puts together, he mingles a perverse or a dizzy or a giddy spirit of giddiness in the middle of the nation. That is his very heart, the center of it. And they have caused Egypt to err in every work. That is, these civil rulers now, the governors, these princes of Zoan and Noph, that are the states of the people, cause the entire nation to err in everything they do. See, so here are the leaders of the people leading them into error in everything. Every work of their hand is now polluted because they have been seduced, because God has knocked out the noggins on these rulers and left them half brain dead or something. I mean, that's why it's so disheartening to watch C-SPAN, I'm told. Because all of a sudden these scriptures become alive in front of your eyes. Verse 15, neither shall there be any work for Egypt which the head or tail, branch or rush may do. Now this is a total depression here being signified. There is no work for it to do. It cannot even earn a living. There are no trades. Trade is gone. Trade imbalance is enormous. A massive depression. So all economic activity has been demolished and destroyed. So you can't even support yourself. Okay. Bad enough that people who live off the land and own land have problems because of the drought, and their ponds for their fishes dry up, and those who own the flax. But what about the wage earners who don't own their own land but work for somebody else? They're in even a worse spot. Nobody can find a job. Joblessness goes through the roof, and what work there is at, you know, break-even rates. Look what happened to our country in the Great Depression and how close we are to getting back into one. If you look at it, the evidence objectively. See, so everything comes apart at the seams when God judges a nation internally, including a huge level of joblessness and depression, economic ruin. Total. And it says, which the head or tail, branch or rush may do. That is, from the greatest in society, the most intelligent man with the five PhDs and engineering, this and that, to the person who is an unskilled laborer who can only dig the ditches, none of them can find work for them to do. Nothing. Verse 16, in that day shall Egypt be like unto women, and it shall be afraid and fear because of the shaking of the hand of the Lord of hosts, which he shaketh over it. So they become as women, and they become fearful people, from the least to the greatest. This is basically the better read than dead scenario. Better do what they say. Ooh, those Russians are scary people. Things like this. That's why that mutually assured destruction would never have worked as a policy on a godly nation. See, well, we don't trust in the mutually assured destruction, we trust in God. So, what is a thermonuclear weapon to the Lord Almighty but a firecracker that he can snuff out with his pinky? You know, what is that? What relevance is that? And the land of Judah shall be a terror unto Egypt. Everyone that maketh mention thereof shall be afraid in himself, because of the counsel of the Lord of hosts, which he hath determined against it. So now, knowledge of Judah presents a problem, because the reason they're being judged, as I pointed out before, is that they seduced Judah. They seduced God's covenant people. And now they're being blown away for it. And so the mention of Judah is an astonishment and a terror to them, in the same sense that if a man saw ravished another lady, and it was exposed, and every time he saw that lady in public thereafter, he'd blush, and with acuteness that everyone would know what he had done. See, that would be that kind of situation. So every time Egypt sees Judah, they blush and they're upset and they're unhappy and terrorized because they know we did something that to them that God got really upset about. In other words, they become acutely aware of their guilt with respect to Judah. Therefore, this is a Calvin's explanation of it. They see it in the same sense as, you know, the man who looks upon the woman that he had ravished and suddenly becomes embarrassed and blushed because of the public recognition of his act and its public exposure. So that's why Judah has become a terror or an astonishment to Egypt on account of this effect. Now, a very fortunate thing happens after verse 18 is that the nation is redeemed, and God does finally gather it together with Judah and with Assyria. But this waits till the end of time for that to happen. It's not going to happen, I don't believe, in the foreseeable future, but it's a certainty. We don't want to go into verse 18 and beyond because it's beyond our purpose today. But it's good to know that there's good news at the end of this very, very dark tunnel, that a nation going all the way to this level of destruction as Egypt ended up undergoing can still be redeemed by God's hand. It's not the beginning of the end and a final ultimate ruin. But it was, the entire time, was a preparation for many centuries later, a restoration with God's hand gathering them together. And they would always remember these things and these harsh judgments that God gave them as the 2x4 over the head to get their attention, that they would never, ever again work against the purposes of God, and they would always take into account God's counsel, and therefore that they would be blessed in the work of their hands. Now what this tells me right off the bat is that if a nation is suffering from any of these things, which are clearly emblematic of God's internal judgment on a nation, we better look for the cause. Or it can be a moral cause against biblical law. If there's depressions, and if there's destruction of these industries, and if the rulers are becoming idiotic and leading the nation into error and seduction away from the truth and away from righteousness, then that's not necessarily the cause of the judgment. That might be an effect of something else in the nation's heart, that it's led itself away from the true worship of Jehovah, and, in the case of Egypt, is seducing others to do likewise. I look at our public school system and say, the entire thing is engineered to generate as many atheists as possible. The omission of God, the deliberate omission of God, and the removal of Bibles even from school buses when children are reading on the way to school. It's things like this. We are leading people away from the true God. And therefore, this, when we talk about, well, the senators voted this and the judges did this at Roe versus Wade, we probably have to go take several steps backward to see where the real sin in the nation was that caused God in a swift cloud to take away our discernment and justice and our righteousness, supposed righteousness, and give us rulers like that. Because there's no chance in it, and we're probably not looking at the right cause. We're probably looking at effects that we think are the causes of today's problem, and in fact, that is an effect of another cause that went before in the nation's history, just as it was with Egypt. These things were not the cause of Egypt's downfall. There was something that happened before that sent these things by God's hand that was the cause of Egypt's downfall. So, too, I have a big problem that if we're going in there and replacing elected officials, it's not going to work because digging ponds didn't work to save the fish. So, too, every ruler you're going to put in there is going to turn on you. Thurgood Marshall went in as a conservative, I believe, when he became a justice of the Supreme Court. And look what happened to him. Most outspoken proponent, I guess, bar one, I suppose, Brennan, I think, or Douglas, I forget which, for abortion rights. Okay? So you can never tell what's going to go on. We are just, and we look at us and our candidates that we have for office all the time, and we say, not a single good one in the bunch. They're all bozos who did the bureaucratic right thing and kept their mouth shut and kept their nose clean, but other than that, there's no redeeming qualities in them. They're chameleons that change shape and moral stature to please the pollsters. Well, that's not the cause of the judgment. That's the effect. The previous several steps back. And if we miss that, we're going to be dealing with effects, and we're going to be no more effective than the Egyptians were in digging ponds to try to rectify the Nile drying up. There's a sluices in the ponds, they're not going to help. And going after council, God says you're going to destroy the council. See? The princes are not. And you just aren't going to get anywhere replacing the princes. If the underlying root cause of the destruction and the decay of the nation hasn't been... And look what they have to do to get back on track. That's probably one reason why we should consider verse 18 and beyond. They swear by the name of the Lord Jehovah. And they speak with the lip of Canaan. It is a wholehearted turning to God. Because this nation once was wholeheartedly turned to God. And look how far we've come from that position. So failure to do this at the national level is not going to solve the problem. You can't put good princes in there and think that solves the problem. I don't think you can get them in. Not going to happen. Because the people are going to be seduced as well. People are seduced into all sorts of things. And self-interest determines more what the people do than anything else. See? So only when we set our minds and hearts on God are we going to solve the present problem with our nation. Not by saying, vote Republican, vote conservative, vote Pat Robertson in as president. Yeah, I'm sad to say, it's going to be as a cosmetic a fix as can be imagined. Because we've had our share of Christian presidents in the last couple decades, and they've been real losers on all counts. They are still, matter of fact, regrettably, part of the judgment of God that we get them too. And we deserve them. And we deserve them for things we don't yet recognize because we've become brutish in our understanding. So we need to go back a step. Watch what happened to Egypt in Isaiah 19 and see America in that same spot. And then we'll see clear how to get the mote out of America's eye without us dictating to Iraq how to operate and how whether Lithuania should stick with the Soviet Union. You know, the horrible Chicken Kiev speech which Bush gave to the Ukrainians against seceding from the despots of Moscow. We start issuing instructions like this, showing the total poverty of moral power in our thinking. And it all is effect, it's not cause. And we miss the boat and solve the problem improperly and not at all if we deal with the effects. See? So political action, yes. Political action better be framed in the right frame because we're going to be in a gamaliel kind of situation as we described last week. We're going to be building walls that God's going to knock down and defending against something that God doesn't intend to defend. God never intended to take Israel back to Jerusalem and to the Holy Land until after 70 years were accomplished for Sabbaths. And getting there just one day too early was not going to be blessed by God and would be confounded. So too, we need to do it God's way or no way. That simple. So there's no element of chance in God's judgment, but we read here that God's judgment was to open our eyes to secure the benefits and blessings of God by repenting from the actual sin that's at the root. And we can identify that pretty easily if we open our eyes and look at our nation real closely. Any questions now about our lesson?
How do you see this possibly figuring in the Iraqi situation? The description in Isaiah 19 about giving cruel rulers and so on to the people. I mean, here you have a nation that worships Muhammad,
right,
and so on. It clearly is due for and ripe for judgment in God's eyes. And what do we do as people? I guess there's the separate areas of separate spheres of government. We kind of have to stay out of that and let God deal with that. But it gets more complicated now after the war with these UN sanctions and UN, you know, the peace treaty and so on, and what Hussein has agreed to do. And I heard on our radio station on a talk show, you know, Stewart is saying, you know, America's got to stand up and someone's got to go over and, you know, we've got to put this to rest because, after all, the guy could be hiding nuclear weapons and so on. We don't know whether or not America's got to do this. And I'm thinking, you know, when did America become King of Kings and Lord of Lords that needs to do that? But there's also the, I mean, the issue of what Hussein agreed to do, and where do you go with that? What do we do now when the UN, Hussein is apparently ignoring UN sanctions and so on? I mean, obviously the UN is a wicked organization to begin with, comprised of a number of ungodly nations, mostly ungodly nations, and probably including the United States. What do we do now? What should we do over in Iraq, given the current situation?
Well, honestly, it's none of our business to be over there. And we certainly should not be propagating the UN dogmas, because that only enforces the situation that the UN prefers, which is the right to dictate to its members, which, as we know, majoritarianism can be the tyranny of the minority. So what can in principle work fine, supposedly fine, against a guy like Hussein, because he's evil, therefore it's justified, may also work against a just nation many times. I mean, we continually make that appeal. We just couldn't care less what the Hague World Court said about our mining harbors. We told them to stick it. See? So we're very selective in our choice of things.
So ideally then you're saying that the solution, or what would need to be done now, would be for America, really, as a nation, to repent of its involvement in such an organization, repent of its involvement in the past and attempts to coordinate world affairs.
Oh, certainly.
And so on.
I imagine how well the UN would be off if America left it.
Right.
I mean, so go find another building. We're going to rent this out to the homeless in New York. It should be a very nice building for that purpose. But that's the right thing to do. I mean, it would fall apart like the League of Nations fell apart, and it deserves to fall apart because it's artificially glued together by our stupid rulers. We should not have participated in it, and the whole premise was, look, what you got to stop world Hitlers from coming back again. The United Nations was born in the heels of World War II for the same reason that the League of Nations was born after World War I, which is to try to figure out a way to stop God's judgments from coming on these ungodly nations. So then ungodly nations gather themselves together against God and His anointed and try to cast His bonds from them. And that's what the UN symbolizes, lock, stock, and barrel, without any question. When you read their human rights and child's rights statements, and these are just frontal attacks on Scripture. They're just, from the pit of hell. And so to say there's some good in it, a little leaven leavens the whole lump. If there's some good in the execution of innocent men because there's more food to go around after he's gone, I mean, that's the kind of reasoning I would liken it to say there's some good in belonging to the UN and fighting alongside with these guys. It's the same category.
Well, how do you suppose we got so far in just the switch from one president to the next? Because Reagan was so down on the UN and involvement in using the UN, and now Bush just seems to use it as it's his first ally.
Right. Well, of course, he was an ambassador to the UN for a long time, so he knows the organization well, which Reagan did not. Reagan knew California well, and Hollywood well, and shoot-em-ups well. And so Reagan did well at the shoot-em-up level with Libya and things like that.
Yeah.
But we're going to be called on the carpet for what we're doing in Iraq.
Yeah.
We bombed all the main Christian sites. We didn't touch a single Muslim mosque. We bombed Christian churches left and right.
Yeah.
More than half of them were destroyed, but we didn't touch any mosques. So it was open game on Christians in Iraq, but we protected the Islamic religion. This God's going to call us on the carpet for, and there's nothing that anyone can say that's going to stop God from judging the destruction of these Christians that were singled out for destruction when Iraq was bombed. We had dirty hands, and there's a pretense and a lie for us to say we have any clean hands to merit going in against Iraq at any time, and Saddam Hussein knows it. So what kind of people are these that bomb their own Christians and leave my mosques intact? Well, I'm good. Appreciate the question.